Friends, welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles. To quote the bard, "Lord, what fools these mortals be." Yes, Midsummer's Night has passed, but in reading some of this summer's top titles, Puck's quote from A Midsummer's Night's Dream popped into my mind. Today we'll look at new books that delve into the messes we mortals always seem to make of our lives and our loves. And men and women authors share our spotlight today, as emotional conundrums are not limited to the fairer sex. I'm thrilled to have as my guest today Jojo Moyes, whose many bestsellers exemplify the way we inadvertently and repeatedly, with the best of intentions, botch up our relationships. I'm sure you'll enjoy learning about her new title, 1+1. So let's begin as we turn to page 1 of the book report. First off on the book report, a book with a great title and reader reviews to match. Courtney Malm's I Am Having So Much Fun Here Without You. Despite the success of his first solo show in Paris and the support of his brilliant French wife and young daughter, 34-year-old British artist Richard Haddon is too busy mourning the loss of his American mistress to appreciate his fortune. But after Richard discovers that a painting he originally made for his wife has sold, it shocks him back to reality. He resolves to reinvest wholeheartedly in his family life, just in time for his wife to learn the extent of his affair. Rudderless and remorseful, Richard embarks on a series of misguided attempts to win his wife back, while focusing his energy on creating a provocative piece of art to prove he's still the man she once loved. Sam Devereaux performs the book that critics call equally funny and touching, a sincere exploration of love and monogamy.
The streetlight cut into the car, illuminating the steering wheel, the dusty dashboard, the humming, buzzing electroland of our interior mobile world. Anne had had her hair done. I knew better than to ask, but I recognized the scent of the hairspray that made its metallic strawberry way twice a month into our lives. I looked into her eyes that she had lined beautifully in the nonchalant and yet studied manner of the French. I forced a smile. "No, I didn't." "Good," she said, edging the car out of the parking spot. "Cam-Cam, we'll have a little snack when we get home." Paris. Paris at night. Paris at night is a street show of 100 moments you might have lived. You might have been the couple beneath the street lamp by the Place de la Concorde, holding out a camera directed at themselves. You might have been the old man on the bridge staring at the houseboats. You might have been the person that girl was smiling in response to as she crossed that same bridge on her cell phone. Or you might be a man in a French export engaged in a discussion about liquid yogurt with his wife. Paris is a city of 100 million lights, and sometimes they flicker. Sometimes they go out. Anne pushed on the radio, set it to the news. The molten contralto of the female announcer filled the silence of our car. At an opening of a meeting at Camp David, British Prime Minister Tony Blair fully endorsed President Bush's intention to find and destroy the weapons of mass destruction purportedly hidden in Iraq. And then, the reedy liltings of my once proud Prime Minister. "The policy of inaction is not a policy we can responsibly subscribe to." "Right," said Anne. "Inaction." "It's madness," I said, ignoring her pointed phrasing. "People getting scared because they're told to be, without asking why." Anne flicked on the blinker. "It's mostly displacement, I think. Verschiebung." She tilted her chin up, proud of her arsenal of comp-lit terms stored from undergrad. "The big questions are too frightening, you know. Where to actually place blame. So they've picked an easy target." "You think France will go along with it?" Her eyes darkened. "Never." I looked out the window at the endless river below us, dividing the right bank from the left bank, the rich from the richer. "It's a bad sign, though," Blair joining up, I added. I mean, the British. We used to question things to death. Anne nodded and fell silent. The announcer went on to summarize the fiscal situation across the Eurozone since the introduction of the euro in January of 2002. Anne turned down the volume and looked in the rearview mirror. Cam, honey, did you have a good time? It was okay, our daughter Camille said, fiddling with her dress.
My favorite is the one with all the bicycles and the one in the kitchen, and then the one with the blue bear that used to be in my room.
I closed my eyes at all the women, even the small ones who wield words like wands, their phrases sugary and innocuous one minute, corrosive the next. Aesthetically, the blue bear was one of the largest and thus most expensive paintings in the show, but because I had originally painted it as a gift for Anne, it was also the most barbed. At 117 by 140 centimeters, the blue bear is an oil painting of the guest room in a friend's rickety, draft-ridden house in Centerville, Cape Cod, where we'd planned to spend the summer after grad school riding out the what-now crests of our mid-twenties, and to consider baby-making, which, if it wouldn't answer the what-now question, would certainly answer, what next?
That was I Am Having So Much Fun Here Without You by Courtney Maum. Jojo Moyes was raised in London. After a varied career, including stints as a minicab controller and a typer of Braille statements for the blind, she turned to journalism. Jojo spent a year at the South China Morning Post in Hong Kong and 9 years at Britain's The Independent. Luckily for her fans, Jojo has been a full-time novelist since 2002, when her first book, Sheltering Rain, was published. Since then, she's written 11 more novels, including Me Before You, which was nominated for Book of the Year at the UK Galaxy Book Awards. A New York Times reviewer had this to say about the book. When I finished the novel, I didn't want to review it. I wanted to reread it. Jojo now lives and writes on a farm in Essex, England, with her husband and their three children. Today we'll be getting the inside story about her chart-topping title, One Plus One. Welcome, Jojo. It's wonderful to have you with us on the Book Report.
Thank you for having me.
You write in One Plus One, families come in all different shapes and sizes. Introduce us to Jess, Tansy, and Nick.
Okay, well, Jess is a single mom. She's trying to raise two kids, one of whom is not actually her own. He's the son of her ex-husband who has disappeared for 2 years. And she's like a lot of single moms in that she's just trying to keep food on the family table, keep her kids happy and on the straight and narrow in the face of all sorts of temptations. And, you know, she's just kind of quietly heroic, really. And Tansy, her daughter, her biological daughter, is 10, and she's a child who doesn't necessarily fit the normal mold. She's actually a maths genius. She sees the world through numbers, and she's desperate to attend a fee-paying private school so that she can kind of really fulfill her ambitions to be a mathematician. But when your parents have no money, that's kind of a tough call. And then there's Nicky, her stepson, who is 16, who is struggling with bullies at the school that he's at. He's a bit of a goth. He wears mascara. He doesn't fit into a small town. And he's the sort of living proof for Jess of a saying I once heard, which is that you're only as happy as your unhappiest child. And the whole of the early part of the book is just filled with a kind of drumbeat of worry for Jess, is wondering what's going to happen to Nicky next.
Yeah. You know, Marty, who is, I would call him a deadbeat dad, features prominently in the story. And I'm not sure you were hard enough on him. How have other readers responded to him?
Do you know, you are not the first person to say that. Yeah, maybe I was a little light on him. I thought it would be really easy to turn Marty into a kind of pantomime villain. I didn't want him to just be a straightforward maintenance-avoiding dad. I think he's like a lot of men who find themselves in a position where they are just totally out of their depth. He's basically a weak man, and he doesn't really want to lose touch with his kids, but he's just not quite strong enough to maintain it either. And the thing about fathers like that is what you have to remember is it doesn't matter what anybody thinks about whether he's, you know, a really bum dad, but what matters is whether the children are allowed to love him anyway. And I guess what Jess does is she puts aside her personal feelings about him and lets them still love their dad, which is kind of a heroic thing in itself.
Absolutely. And then there's Ed, who's a geeky kind of a genius who got in trouble when he wasn't using his brain for a solution to a problem. Fill us in about him.
That's a very diplomatic way of putting it.
Thank you.
Yeah. Basically, you know, my husband works in technology, and one of the things that kind of amuses me is you have a raft of young men who have made huge fortunes by being good at software and at binary code and numbers and all the rest of it, but without necessarily the business or even common sense to go with the position of great power. And that's where we find Ed. You know, he's basically a geek who is totally out of his depth, and as a result makes a decision, not with his brain, as you say, to do with an ex-girlfriend, and then finds himself being prosecuted for insider trading. And so when he meets Jess, both of them are at a kind of crucial point in their lives. He's trying to avoid telling his parents what's happened to him, and he's kind of running away from what's happened to him. And she is desperately trying to find a way to get her daughter to a maths Olympiad to earn the money, to win the money so that she can go to this school.
Right. You know, the road trip is central to your story. Did you draw inspiration from classic novels that featured a road trip?
Yes. You know, I am an absolute fan of The Road Trip, and I've always wanted to write one. And, you know, I think one of my favorite films ever is Thelma and Louise. I also love Little Miss Sunshine, On the Road. You know, you name it. It's that perfect thing of putting people in a close confine and seeing what happens when they're forced to rub up next to each other day after day. Because there's no greater way to find out someone's strengths and weaknesses than to have to sit next to them for hour after hour, as anybody who's done a long-haul flight knows.
Right.
So, yeah, I guess also the book that I wrote before that, a book called The Girl You Left Behind, was a huge sort of sprawling epic that began in the First World War and ended in the modern day. And so what I tend to do is write a book in reaction to the last one. So what I wanted to do this time was to write something that was very small, very tight, a very small cast of characters, and that became my road storybook, really.
We're speaking with JoJo Moyes on The Book Report. You know, your characters are quirky but very believable. Did they just pop up in your brain fully formed, or how do you create them?
Well, sometimes they do, if I'm lucky, but mostly they don't. Mostly I have to kind of build them almost mechanically. I have a whole routine that I do where before I start writing a book, I go out and I buy a kind of A4 hardbacked pad, no lines, very specific, and a really nice black pen. And I set about creating each of these characters. And so I ask myself as many questions as I can about them. You know, where do they come from? What do their parents do? What do they like? What's their motivation? And then I put them through tests as well. I say, you know, if they were to come down and raid the fridge in the middle of the night, how would that be? You know, would there be food in the fridge? Would they be naked? Would they avoid the food? Would they eat compulsively? And what you do is you put them through these little tests and you find out an awful lot about your character. And then what happens is, by the time you start writing them, you're probably not even going to use 5% of the information that you've compiled about them. But what it does is it changes the way they come onto the page, and it changes the way they respond to each other. So you already know that person, which really makes, I think it makes it come alive. And the times that I've gone wrong with my writing are the times that I haven't done enough work on the characters beforehand.
That was really illuminating. I've never heard it described that concisely. You know, this book puts a spotlight on bullying. What led you to focus on this issue now?
Well, you know, I have two teenage children and one younger one, and I've spent a lot of time in schools and around schools and listening to what my kids have to say. And bullying is a real issue. Thankfully, not for mine so much, but I think the issues that kids today face are so much more complex than what we had to face. You know, when I grew up, I got bullied a little at my first school, and it was a kind of matter of name-calling and pushing around in the playground, and then you went home and told your mum, and your mum came in and you begged her not to, and it was all sorted out. Now it's much more insidious. Now it's on social media, it's on people's phones, there's, you know, hacking of web pages. This, you only have to open a newspaper to see the kind of amazingly inventive ways that kids find to torture each other. And I just think it's really hard for them. And unless parents are prepared to kind of really listen and be creative and non-judgmental in their response, it's very hard for these kids to negotiate this stuff without help. So, yeah, I guess I just wanted to show that you can be a really caring parent, but you're still not necessarily going to be able to find your way around some of these issues without help.
You were a successful journalist for 10 years. What was it that made you leave journalism and begin writing novels?
Well, it was a couple of things, really. One is that I just always wanted to write books. You know, I wrote 3 books while I was a journalist that didn't get published. But also, you know, I had my first child. I used to be one of those reporters who ran around with a passport in my handbag. You know, I never knew what I was going to do from one day to the next. And when you have a baby, you realize you can't live like that. You just, you know, you've got to know that you're going to be there at 6 o'clock. So I guess I just started to work harder and harder at my writing in my spare time. And now I look back and I can't believe that I had that much energy. But luckily for me, by the time I was pregnant with my second child, I got a book deal. And so, yeah, it was logistics. But I did miss journalism for about 2 years. I really, really missed it. I missed the camaraderie of it because, you know, when you write by yourself in a room all day, it can be quite lonely.
Yes. Any final thoughts on 1+1?
Well, I really like when I'm reading to be made to laugh and cry and not necessarily know what's coming next. And I really hope that if readers read this, that that's a little bit of what they'll get from this book.
Well, thank you so much, Jojo, for joining us today. I love the book. I really recommend it.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure being here.
All right. Bye now.
Bye.
And now, let's listen to a sampling of 1+1, performed by an ensemble cast.
Jess Thomas and Natalie Benson slumped in the seats of their van, which was parked far enough away from Natalie's house that they couldn't be seen from the inside. Natalie was smoking. She had given it up for the fourth time 6 weeks ago.
£80 a week guaranteed and holiday pay?
Natalie let out a scream.
Bloody hell! I actually want to find the tart who left that earring and thump her for losing us our best job.
Maybe she didn't know he was married.
Oh, she knew.
Before she'd met Dean, Natalie had spent 2 years with a man who turned out to have not one, but 2 families on the other side of Southampton.
No single man keeps colour-coordinated scatter cushions on his bed.
Neil Brewster does, Jess said.
Neil Brewster's music collection is 67% Judy Garland, 33% Pet Shop Boys.
They had cleaned together every weekday for 4 years, since back when the beachfront holiday park was part paradise, part building site. Back when the developers promised local families access to the swimming pool and assured everyone that a large upmarket development would bring benefits to their little seaside town, instead of sucking out what remained of its life. The faded moniker, Benson and Thomas Cleaning, was stenciled on the side of their white van. Natalie had added underneath,
"A bit dirty. Can we help?"
Until Jess pointed out that for 2 whole months, half the calls they had received had been nothing to do with cleaning. Nearly all their jobs were in the beachfront development now. Hardly anybody in town had the money or the inclination to hire a cleaner, except for the doctors, the solicitor, and the odd client like Mrs. Humphrey, whose arthritis had stopped her from doing it herself. It was a good job on the one hand. You could work for yourself, organise your own hours, pick and choose your clients for the most part. The downside, weirdly, was not the crappy clients, and there always was at least one crappy client, or that scrubbing someone else's toilet somehow left you feeling like you were one step lower on a ladder than you had planned to be. Jess didn't mind pulling lumps of hair out of other people's plug holes, or the fact that most people who rented holiday homes seemed to feel obliged to live like pigs for a week. What she didn't like was that you ended up finding out much more about other people's lives than you really wanted to. Jess could have told you about Mrs. Eldridge's secret shopping habit, the designer shoe receipt she stuffed into the bathroom bin, and the bags of unworn clothes in her wardrobe, the tags still firmly attached. She could tell you that Lena Thompson had been trying for a baby for 4 years and used 2 pregnancy tests a month. Rumour had it, she left her tights on. She could tell you that Mr. Mitchell, in the big house behind the church, earned a 6-figure salary. He left his payslips on the hall table. Natalie swore he did it deliberately. And that his daughter smoked secretly in the bathroom and lined up all her cigarette butts in neat rows on the window ledge. If she was that way inclined, she could have pointed out the women who went out looking immaculate, hair faultless, nails polished, lightly spritzed with expensive scent, who thought nothing of leaving soiled knickers in full view on the floor. Or the teenage boys whose stiff towels she didn't want to pick up without a pair of tongs. There were the couples who spent every night in separate beds, the wives insisting brightly when they asked her to change the spare room sheets that they'd had an awful lot of guests lately. The lavatories that required a gas mask and a Hazchem warning. And then, every now and then, you got a nice client like Lisa Ritter and popped over to vacuum her floors and came home with a whole load of knowledge you could really have done without.
We've just heard One Plus One by JoJo Moyes. Three-year-old Shay Rigsby has spent her entire life in Walker, Texas, a small college town that lives and dies by football, a passion she shares. Raised alongside her best friend Lucy, the daughter of Walker's legendary head coach, Shay was too devoted to her hometown team to leave. Instead, she stayed in Walker for college, even taking a job at the university athletic department after graduation, a job she still holds 10 years later. But when an unexpected tragedy strikes the tight-knit Walker community, Shay's comfortable world is upended, and she begins to wonder if the life she's chosen is really enough for her. As she finally gives up her safety net to set out on an unexpected path, Shay discovers unsettling truths about the people and things she has always trusted most, and she's forced to confront her deepest desires, fears, and secrets. Sophia Willingham narrates.
I shivered at the finality of it all, cursing the cancer that took Mrs. Carr's life in 10 months flat, not a single symptom until it was too late. Recognizing that praying wasn't at all like riding a bicycle, I bowed my head and formed silent, clumsy words, doing my best not to question God's existence while I asked him for favors. Please help Lucy find a way to be happy without her mother. It felt like an impossible request, and the fact that she had her own daughter, just turned 4-year-old Caroline, who was too young to attend the funeral, or one day remember her Gigi, seemed to heighten all the emotions of loss. A new generation was a constant reminder of everything Mrs. Carr was going to miss. Birthdays, benchmarks, all of life's momentous firsts stretched ahead without her. I turned my gaze and prayers to Lawton, Lucy's brother, a carefree bachelor, but still a mama's boy to the core. He was standing beside his sister, mopping his face with a handkerchief, likely one Mrs. Carr had pressed for him in anticipation of this day. She had made a flurry of arrangements and plans over the past few months, including a morphine-induced request for Lawton and me to marry. "Kill 2 birds with 1 stone," she had said. Not exactly a flattering or hopeful description. That wasn't going to happen. Lawton wasn't my type, and I was even less his. But I had smiled and told her I'd work on it, while Lucy made a joke about every couple needing at least 1 grown-up. I looked up at the sun streaming through the stained glass behind the altar, wondering if Mrs. Carr was somewhere up there, watching us. And if so, could she read my mind? Just in case, I said a final goodbye to her, my throat tight and dry. Then I closed my eyes and mouthed, "Amen," aware of the glaring omission in my prayer, "Coach Carr." When I looked up again, he was directly in my line of vision, walking from the opposite end of the casket toward the pew in front of me, his hands clasped behind his back, the way he paced the sidelines of a game. I heard him exhale as he took his seat, close enough for me to touch his shoulder if I only extended my hand and leaned forward a few inches. But I couldn't so much as look at him. Hadn't been able to in weeks, even when I dropped by the house with store-bought casseroles and 6-packs of Shiner Bock. I knew he was devastated, and the mere notion that I might glimpse him in a vulnerable moment was unbearable, like looking at those award-winning photos of soldiers or firemen holding babies, weeping after a catastrophe. I firmly believed that it was always harder to be the one left behind, especially if you thought you were on your way to happily ever after. Coach and Connie Carr's story fittingly began at Walker University, the school with the same name as our small town in North Texas, where he was the star quarterback and she the prettiest cheerleader. Except for the one season he played for the Colts, just after Lucy and I were born, the Carrs never left Walker as he worked his way up the coaching ladder from quarterback's coach to offensive coordinator to the youngest, and now the winningest, head coach in Bronco history. Coach Carr was something of a deity in our town. Throughout the state of Texas and in the world of college football, which happened to be the only world I truly cared about, and Connie had been royalty in her own right.
That was The One and Only by Emily Giffen. Michelle Hanavan's Off Course is set in 1981. Reagan is in the White House, and the country is stalled in a recession. Cressida Hartley, a gifted PhD student in economics, moves into her parents' shabby A-frame cabin in the Sierras to write her dissertation. Cress, increasingly resistant to her topic of art in the marketplace, allows herself to be drawn into the social life of the small mountain community. The local lodge owner, Jakey Yates, with his big personality, is the first to blur Cress's focus. The builder, Rick Garsh, gives her a job driving up and down the mountain for supplies. And then there are the two Morrow brothers, skilled carpenters who are witty, intriguing, and married. As Cress tells her best friend back home in Pasadena, being a single woman in the mountains amounts to a form of public service. Falling prey to her own perilous reasoning, she soon finds herself in dark new territory. Amy Rubinate narrates.
The sun had already slid behind Shale Mountain when she arrived, though another hour of light remained. She set up her typewriter on a card table in the living room. The air was warm and dusty. Heat still shimmered off the deck. Outside, with her feet on the railing, she enjoyed a small portion of her mother's bourbon until the mosquitoes found her. Another reason she'd hated the cabin. No comfortable place to settle in. A wicker loveseat was too hard. The built-in window seat was better, at least she could stretch out, but narrow and also hard, its cushion degraded from years of direct sun. She grabbed the top issue from a 2-foot stack of New Yorkers, then couldn't stay awake. At 8, ignoring the thermometer and temperature log, she went to her usual room, the enclosed loft with an ultra-firm queen-size bed that nobody else would sleep on. The day's warmth had collected in a familiar stuffiness. She wrestled the window open along its corroded aluminum track. Wind soughed through the trees, bearing the scent of pine and mineral dust. The moon cast a blue glow. As a child, alone in this room, she'd often heard a distant chorus singing in the highest registers. She knew that the singing came from her own mind, that it was a response to silence, and often the prelude to a headache. She stretched out on the unforgiving bed and closed her eyes. There, at the very edge of hearing, far, far away, 1,000 voices labored a cappella. And so it was, on the familiar roads in her family's other home, with the blessings of those closest to her, that she veered off course into the woods. Morning brought still more reminders of why she'd hated the cabin. A panging headache, a weird gluey lethargy, small wheeling prisms in her vision. Her mother had attributed these symptoms to Cress's attitude, admittedly rotten. But Sylvia Hartley was off by a letter, as Cress had discovered camping in the Tetons and skiing in Utah. Anywhere above 6,000 feet, she was a poor adapter. She phoned Tilly in Pasadena at 7:40 a.m. "My head's like an old hangover cartoon," she said, "with little devils pitchforking my eyeballs." "Why are you calling so early?" said Tilly. "The rates go up at 8. They got off the phone a minute before. Cress squinted at the clock. The thermometer hung on the porch, sight unseen. She took 3 aspirin, then chopped carrots, onions, and celery, and made enough lentil soup for a week, possibly a lifetime. She stuffed a man's large red mitten with ice, and, stretching out on the window seat, placed it over her eyes. The aroma of the soup must have carried outside. The porch creaked, and Cress lifted the mitten. A very large dog nosed the sliding glass door, as if waiting to be let in. She stood, too fast, setting the prisms into a frenzied whirl, and the creature, too, rose up on his hind legs. A bear. He stood like a man, his arms hanging, his head cocked, so that his long, whitened snout slanted upward against the glass. One eye, displeasingly small, yellowish, not intelligent, squinted in at her. The visible ear, round at the top and pinched at the stem, lent him a comical stuffed toy look. He was definitely a he. In the sparser fur of the lower belly was a hairier, vertical thicket, with something stuck on it. A dry leaf? A bit of bark? His own crustiness? Perhaps overconfident of the thermopane, Cress moved closer. Her heart, which recognized danger, began to race. But when had she ever been this close? She knew from childhood admonitions, mustn't meet his eye. He was not a handsome or hygienic bear. No, his coat dirty, clumped, its dull brown bleached unevenly on the ends. His black nostrils quivered, steamed the glass, and slid against it in dark, shiny adhesions, leaving smears. The claws, translucent black crescents, looked like plastic. She moved closer yet, and he dropped back to all fours. Dog-like again, he lumbered down the steps, shoulders rolling. The whole cabin shuddered.
We've just heard Off Course by Michelle Hunnevin. Barbara Mutch's stunning first novel, The Housemaid's Daughter, tells the story of love and duty colliding on the arid plains of apartheid-era South Africa. When Kathleen Harrington leaves her home in Ireland in 1919 to travel to South Africa, she knows she does not love the man she is to marry there, her fiancé Edward, whom she has not seen for 5 years. Isolated and estranged in a small town in the harsh Karoo Desert, her only real companions are her diary and her housemaid, and later, the housemaid's daughter, Ada. When Ada is born, Kathleen recognizes in her someone she can love. Under Kathleen's tutelage, Ada grows into an accomplished pianist and a reader who cannot resist turning the pages of the diary, discovering the secrets Kathleen sought to hide. As they grow closer, Ada sees new possibilities in front of her. But in one night, everything changes, and Kathleen comes home from a trip to find that Ada has disappeared, scorned by her own community. Kathleen must make a choice. Should she conform to society or search for the girl who has become closer to her than her own daughter? Bonnie Turpin and Kat Gould share the narration.
The narrow stairs and the brass doorknobs know my hands and feet. The bony thorn tree and the apricot bush hold me inside them, carrying me in their sap from year to year. And I own a tiny bit of them in return. So when Craddock House was taken away from me, I could not understand my life after that. Craddock lies in the Karoo, the great semi-desert of South Africa that you find whenever you go far enough inland from the Green Mountains that edge the coast in a steep frill. The Karoo is the hard place you have to cross before you reach Johannesburg, where you can dig gold out of the ground and become rich. None of this I knew, of course. My whole world was just a square, two-story house of cream stone with a red tin roof in a small town surrounded by rocky kopjes, brown dust, and a lack of rain. The only water I knew about lay in the Kroot Vis, the great fish river, and sometimes stirred itself to flow along a furrow outside the house, from where it could be led into the garden for the plants to drink. On the edge of town where the sky met the earth, tough karoo bush, hardly ever taller than the height of a child, clung to the dry soil. Above the bush poked the withered trunks of aloes, topped by orange flower spikes that stood out like flames against the scrub. There were some trees, like blue gums or frothy mimosas, but only in front gardens or down on the banks of the Kroot Vis, where their roots could burrow for water. On those few times when it did rain, the hammering on the tin roof was so loud it sent Miss Rosemary and young Master Phil into fits of screaming. My mother and I, in the kaya at the bottom of the garden, also had a tin roof, but ours was grey and overhung by the thorn tree. It damped the hammering into a hiss. I didn't scream at the rain. I stood at the kaya door, listening to it, and looking out over the veldt beyond the fence. When my mother wasn't watching, I would put one bare foot out into the tiny rivers that crept over the hard ground and watch the water pool and sink reluctantly into the ground around my toes. Craddock House sat on Dundas Street, just up from the Kroot Vis and just below Market Square. Dundas became Bree Street about halfway along its length. I don't know why one street needed two names. Mama said perhaps it was a matter of honoring ancestors equally, but that was the way it was. Once the street with two names crossed over Regent Street, it ran out of steam, fell into a township, and disappeared. Craddock House had a wooden stoop with shell chairs to sit on that went almost the whole way around the house, like a circle. It stopped at the kitchen and then picked up again after the laundry, which was just as well, said my mother. Otherwise, we'd want to sit there all day when we should be washing or cooking or ironing. But although I longed to sit in one of those chairs, I was forbidden by my mother to do so. They were for the family, she said. But I am also part of the family, I would say hopefully in return, stroking the grainy wood. Shoo, child, Mama would mutter and tell me to get on with the polishing.
That was a sampling of The Housemaid's Daughter by Barbara Mooch. Love an underdog? Don't we all? Here's a title sure to warm your heart. Craig Lancaster's 600 Hours of Edward. Edward Stanton is a 39-year-old with Asperger's syndrome and obsessive-compulsive disorder. He lives alone on a rigid schedule in the Montana town where he grew up. His carefully constructed routine includes tracking his most common waking time, 7:38 a.m., refusing to start his therapy sessions even a minute before the appointed 10 a.m. hour, and watching one episode of Dragnet each night at 10 p.m. But when a single mom and her 9-year-old son move in across the street, Edward's timetable comes undone. Over the course of 600 hours, he opens up to his new neighbors and confronts old grievances with his estranged parents. Exposed to both the joys and heartaches of friendship, Edward must ultimately decide whether to embrace the outside world or retreat to his solitary ways. If this story snags you, and we think it will, the next title in the series, Edward Adrift, is also available on audio and also performed by Luke Daniels.
While I am intrigued by the notion,
I have to remember that this house was built in 1937, and the cost of retrofitting it for radiant floor heating would be prohibitive. My father could afford it, and it is, in fact, his house and not mine, but he never would do it. He's never here, and so it probably doesn't make any difference to him that radiant floor heating would be a lot more economical. It should matter to him, as he pays the heating bill. But my father sometimes is not a logical person. I can't worry about this now, although I have half a mind to write him a letter and tell him that he is being foolish for not thinking of radiant floor heating. I walk across the hardwood floor of the house, open the front door, and pick the Billings Herald Gleaner off the stoop. According to the front page, the temperature will reach 72 degrees today in Billings, and that is as I suspected when my feet touch the floor. It'll be warm for October 13th. It's far warmer than last October 13th, 56 degrees. Of course, I won't know for sure until tomorrow's newspaper comes, the one with the official temperature for today. The number on the front page today is just a forecast, and forecasts are notoriously off base. I flip over to the back page of the local and state section and look at the weather data from yesterday, Sunday, October 12th, the 286th day of the year, but only because this is a leap year. The weather data is always on the back page of the local and state section, and while it does bother me that the local and state section is sometimes Section B and sometimes Section C, I have learned to cope with this inconsistency, as I have no choice. I once wrote to the editor to complain about it, but I did not receive a reply. The high temperature yesterday was 53, and the low temperature was 31, and those are much more in line with the 10-year trends that I've recorded in my notebooks. I write those numbers down, and my data is complete. My father bought this house 8 years ago. Actually, it was 8 years and 86 days ago. He bought it for me to live in because I had become a distraction whose presence was proving divisive in the family home. My father didn't write those words. His lawyer did. I have never heard my father refer to the family home before or since. The reason I know that his lawyer wrote the letter is that it arrived on the lawyer's letterhead. I do sometimes talk to my father face to face, but many times it is followed up with a letter, sometimes on his letterhead and sometimes on the lawyer's. I have not figured out how to predict which letterhead I will receive, although I can always predict the letters. I don't trust predictions anyway. I prefer facts. I live in this house alone. When my father bought it for me, he made it clear that I was to have no roommates without approval. I don't know why my father worried about it. A roommate would probably mess up my routines and fool with my weather data. I know how roommates are. I have seen the television comedy Perfect Strangers, although not in many years, as it was canceled in 1993. I liked Balki Bartokomous. He was very funny. If I had a roommate like Balki, though, I would have to keep watch over my weather data. His rambunctiousness, I love the word rambunctiousness, would wear on me if he started fooling with my data. The two-drawer filing cabinet in my bedroom holds one of the most important collections I have. Inside are my letters of complaint. I have them filed in green office folders under the name of the person I am complaining to, and in those files, the letters are arranged by date. You are probably thinking that it is odd to keep copies of letters of complaint, and you would be right if not for the fact that these are not copies. These are the actual letters of complaint, and they will never be sent. The letters are Dr. Buckley's idea. I don't know where she got it, but it's a great one. 8 years ago, after my father and his lawyer persuaded Garth Brooks to drop the restraining order against me, my father bought this house for me. He seemed to suggest that the Garth Brooks incident, as he still calls it, was what caused him and my mother to decide that I could no longer live in the family home. I think that my letters of complaint to Garth Brooks were entirely justified. If you look objectively at country music, you cannot come to any conclusion other than he ruined it. He also ruined a lot of pop music, especially when he pretended to be that Chris Gaines person and when he covered that song by Kiss.
We've just heard 600 Hours of Edward by Craig Lancaster. Edward St. Aubyn's Lost for Words is a hilariously smart send-up of a certain major British literary award.
It's been reviewed as a fabulously entertaining satire that cuts to the quick of some of the deepest questions about the place of art in our celebrity-obsessed culture. It ponders how we can ever hope to recognize real talent when everyone has an agenda. The judges on the panel of the Elysian Prize for Literature must get through hundreds of submissions to find the best book of the year. Meanwhile, a host of writers are desperate for Elysian attention. The brilliant writer and serial heartbreaker Catherine Burns, the lovelorn debut novelist Sam Black, and Bungie, convinced that his magnum opus, The Mulberry Elephant, will take the literary world by storm. Things go terribly wrong when Catherine's publisher accidentally submits a cookbook in place of her novel. One of the judges finds himself in the middle of a scandal, and Bungie, aghast to learn that his book isn't on the short list, seeks revenge. Alex Jennings performs the work.
Over the last few weeks, Penny had been so preoccupied by becoming a member of the Elysian Prize Committee that she had neglected her own writing. But she was determined to get back to work on her current thriller, Roger and Out. She clicked a little nervously on its icon and found herself confronted by sentences she hadn't looked at for ages. To give herself a running jump, she reread the beginning of the latest chapter. It was evening in St. James's Park, and the sun, sinking in a westerly direction, had turned the clouds into pink balls of cotton wool. Meanwhile, at ground level, the puddles had already turned into dark pools of glossy chocolate. Sitting in her battered grey Audi A6 3-litre TDI with all-leather seats, Jane Street was ready to call it a day. That was the surveillance game for you, waiting and watching, watching and waiting, but often ending up with nothing to show for it. Then, just as Jane's hand came to rest on the ignition key, Grove's voice blasted into her earpiece. "I have an eyeball. I have an eyeball." The words shot through Jane's body like an electric current. She reached instinctively into the Audi's generous glove compartment and felt for her weapon. The IPX 370 packed the punch of a Colt 38, but its magazine carried that one extra bullet that could make all the difference if things turned nasty. 6 grams shy of its American counterpart, its lighter weight also made a real difference if you had to carry it round in your handbag all day. Jane's hand padded around the glove compartment, but apart from the service manual and a spare packet of Handy Andys, she could feel nothing there. Where the hell was her weapon? Then it all came back with a cold, sickening thud. The shooting range. That morning, Richard Lane. Lane was a classic yes man and pen pusher, with no more idea of the reality of life at the sharp end of things than she had of how to dance the lead role in Tchaikovsky's Swan Lake. Probably less. She had been avoiding Lane like the plague, but he had finally tracked her down at the shooting range and delivered his usual lecture about her cavalier disregard for the proper rules of procedure, her runaway expenses, and her attitude generally. It had made her so angry that she had left her weapon behind. She had spent the whole afternoon fuming and hadn't had a chance to discover her mistake. Now it was too late. Well, damn Lane. Damn all the Lanes, sitting behind their desks in Thames House, watching the shafts of sunlight turn the river lapis lazuli, while their lovesick secretaries made bookings for lunch at Quo Vadis in Soho's Dean Street. What did they know about putting your life on the line for your country? Penny was torn between thinking that the pages were rather good, pacey, well-researched, vivid, and thinking that she was not really a writer at all. Perhaps it had been a huge mistake to retire early from the Foreign Office to pursue her lifelong ambition of becoming an author. It was true that there had been other reasons to leave. Her career had stagnated after its dazzlingly rapid rise during David Hampshire's last years as permanent secretary over 25 years ago. His favouritism had generated so much resentment that she remained stuck at the same level ever after, often moving sideways, but never up. Her affair with David not only ruined her marriage, but arguably ruined her prospects as well. He was still her greatest friend, but the glory days were over when he used to call her "my very own Anna Ford," at a time when the nation's favourite newscaster was considered the most desirable woman on earth. Unlike the delicious Miss Ford, who had confidently allowed her hair to go white, Penny's remained resolutely mahogany, matching her eyes, but increasingly at odds with the sad story told by the sags and creases of her loosening skin. Penny sighed. Nicola had never really forgiven her for the divorce, or if it came to that, for the career. But she wasn't going to think about that now. She must press on, if only to get away from the old feelings of hollow sacrifice that she fought against every day.
We've just heard Lost for Words by Edward St. Aubin. Readers, flawed as we all are, I think you'll agree these stories make great reading. For more from around the wide world of books, be sure to check my website, bookreportradio.com, for suggestions on what to read next. Thanks so much for joining me today. Let's meet again in a week for the next edition of The Book Report.